Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
Hi, welcome back. The Chinese are coming. Well, not really. But that's a concern that many people have about our national debt. So I want to debunk this this myth, and there's others we'll get to, about the Chinese cannot just say, give us back our money. It doesn't work that way. Yes, it's true that the Chinese government or their various investment funds have about $1.3 trillion of U.S. debt that they own. That debt was originally issued with specific terms and conditions and expectations and maturities. So assuming that it's all, say, 10-year notes, then during the time that China or any other investor holds that treasury note or a bond or a bill, any of the three, the investor gets interest. And then at the appointed maturity date, the investor gets their principal back. So this idea, this hysteria, I will suggest it could be called, that the Chinese or any other government can demand their $1.3 trillion back on a whim and thereby have us, quote unquote, over a barrel is nonsense. It doesn't work that way. Now, if there were sufficiently large, what do you call them, armada of Chinese battleships parked off the coast of Washington, D.C., okay, that's different. That's called war, but not on a whim. So get that out of the way, because sometimes in the media's attempt to gain your attention or someone who has an agenda to sell you something, they will use this kind of rhetoric, this kind of inflammatory language, or flat out try to scare the bejesus out of you in order to get you to do something else. And by the way, China's not the only one that owns or holds U.S. debt. Some of our other quote-unquote friends hold a lot of it. Japan is over, they're in the trillion-dollar club. I think they own like 1.1 or so trillion. Great Britain. Oh my gosh, the Redcoats are coming. You know, Great Britain owns a considerable amount as well. In fact, if you look around the globe, a lot of the major countries hold U.S. debt as part of what they would consider a balanced portfolio for their countries. That's just the way it's done. And the reason for all of that, ironically, is because the U.S. debt is still considered one of the safest, most secure forms of governmental debt that you can get because of the likelihood, the strong likelihood that the U.S. government, well, let me rephrase that, U.S. taxpayers will make good on that promise to pay interest and pay the debt back. So it is an unnecessary worry. Don't let anybody tell you that this is an imminent danger, and don't let people scare you. It's silly. And along the same lines, another one that I hear from time to time asked, the government's going to seize our 401k, take all of our money, and leave an IOU note. Pretty unlikely. Yes, it's true that our financial system in the United States, as is the case around the world, is a function of the regulatory controls and structures afforded to that society by the government in place. So it is possible that we could have legislative action, Congress, House and Senate, and then a president, all of which who agree that it is in the everyone's best interest to have a greater control over retirement account. It's possible. That doesn't make it likely. But it's possible. Now, it becomes pretty politically difficult, and I know that people would argue, well, that doesn't mean it's not possible. I didn't say it wasn't possible, but it becomes very difficult to basically nationalize these individual investments. And I think that it's a much, much, much easier path to follow the existing pattern of how our government, the executive and legislative branches, how they get the money to run our government, to handle the affairs of our country. And the way we do that now is by pulling in over $3 trillion in revenue, then spending about $3.5 trillion and borrowing the other half a trillion or $500 billion each year to continue to pay for things. That's a lot easier. It lies much lower under the radar screen than going and taking people's 401k accounts. I mean, it's just very difficult. Now, if that's a concern, there are steps, of course, that people can suggest. If you've got a 401k out there and you want to roll it into an IRA, if you're no longer working for the company, probably easier to roll it into that IRA than to take some sort of more drastic step. By having it in an IRA, it's probably a little harder for somebody to get to the money. But remember, the government knows where your money is in the 401k. And if you have an IRA, they know it's there too. So weigh the likelihood of such an event before you take everything that's in an IRA or 401k, cash it in, pay an accelerated high tax bracket on that money, 30 or more percent tax bracket, to get the money out, to be able to put it into something else that's not government, quote unquote, supervised. And usually where I hear this kind of language or some of these concerns, if you follow the money, get the money out, pay the tax, getting 70 cents is better than getting nothing. This is some of the noise you'll hear. And then take that money and go and buy gold, right? That's the next thing out of the person's mouth. I'm a believer, maybe you could call me an optimist on this, but I'm a believer in our overall financial system. Is it perfect? No. Are there concerns that I have? Sure. Are there things that I don't like? Absolutely. Would like to see some things done differently? You betcha. But as far as financial systems go, I don't think it's going anywhere. Now, I'll wrap up with an obligatory comment on gold. You know, again, some of this is inflammatory, and some of these things that are touted as world ending, they're going to happen tomorrow, so buy gold today. That's a lot of what we hear. But don't stop at gold. There's palladium, there's nickel, there's rhodium, there's all sorts of portable wealth that you can get your hands on that's going to somehow keep the big brother from getting the money. You know, and the predictions often that go along with it is that gold is going to skyrocket. It's going to go to $5,000 an ounce. Demand has never been greater. The world has never looked bleaker. Things have never been this bad or on the precipice of being so bad. It's just a matter of time before the U.S. dollar is ignored and not accepted anywhere in the world. All these things you hear and all these prognostications about the value of gold always are about them going up at some point in the future. You know, if you say it enough times, and if the world goes through cycles, including the U.S., eventually the gold is going to go up. But I got to tell you, it makes me chuckle because every time I look in the paper, and I look right to where gold is, most of the time that arrow is pointing down. So I've told many people, if having a little bit of gold helps you sleep at night, you want to buy a few gold coins, have at it. It's cheaper than a prescription drug to help you sleep. But as far as taking everything you have and dumping it into gold to buy into all of this rhetoric, I think it's overkill. Have a little bit of cash on hand just in case the banks don't work for a few days, but don't go all in on any one thing. If you do that, you'll plan stronger.
Hi, I'm Teresa Rand with the Volusia Flagler YMCA. Our YMCA has 6 locations to help your family reach their health and fitness goals. The WISE Aquatics program is designed to teach personal water safety, stroke development, water sports, games, rescue, and personal growth skills. All participants are taught by our trained and certified YMCA aquatic instructors. For more information on how your YMCA can help with your health and wellness goals, check out www.vfymca.org.
Hi, welcome back. So I get a lot of questions about certain topics when I do financial presentations, and I'd like to debunk some of the myths that I run across or some of the questions that people have. One of the big ones, of course, that you'll hear a lot about during political season will be a lot of things related to our fiscal responsibility, the ability of the government to corral taxpayer dollars to provide certain benefits and entitlements that we have had voted on in previous legislative sessions that become part of our structure, our culture. A big one is Social Security. And the perennial question that we hear is, will Social Security go bankrupt? I'm going to not really go much out on a limb. In fact, I'm going to hug the tree pretty tightly on this, but I still think I can tell you that the answer to that question is very unlikely. I do not think Social Security is going to go bankrupt. And here's why. It's really a numbers game. Are you ready? I've got a statistic for you that really makes the point. According to Social Security Administration, monthly payments from Social Security represent more than 50% of the income for 66% of those 65 or older. So more than half the money coming in on a monthly basis for two-thirds of American over 65. It's a lot of them. And that demographic is very, what's the right word? Determined, consistent in their voting. They will vote. They have more time to vote. They're not having to make it there by a certain time after work in many cases. They will do pre-voting, vote by mail if they're going to be traveling. So they're determined to vote. Do you think they're going to support anybody that's going to give any whiff of not supporting a continuation of Social Security? So I don't think it's going to go bankrupt. And I don't think there's any politician as outspoken or as dumb as they may look. They're not going to get on the wrong side of that because they'll be out. And politicians want to be in. That's why they're there. So that's just the political reality. Now, there are some other realities. Number one, if Social Security Trust Fund, which is projected in, I don't know, 15, 20 years, if there's no changes, to run out of money, and at that point, there is enough money still coming in from people paying Social Security to pay for roughly 70 to 75% of the benefits of what's going out. So even if there's nothing done to capture additional revenue to keep Social Security 100% solvent, there's still going to be 75 or so percent of the benefits. Now, to the people I just mentioned, that two-thirds of those over 65, when they see their paycheck cut, that monthly Social Security benefit paycheck cut to which they rely on substantially, they're going to be getting the check, but it's going to be less. Do you think they may, I don't know, pick up the phone? You think they may do something about it? I bet you they will. Now, more kind of obvious solutions that are out there, they've been talked about quite a bit, and many of them have merit. Some of them may not be popular, but many of them have merit. To save Social Security, here's a couple of them. Push the retirement age out. You know, for me, it's at my full retirement's at age 67. That might get pushed out to 70. The age at which this would really have a big impact, age at which you could take your benefits the earliest. A lot of people take benefits at 62. It's about half. Why? Because it's the earliest they can take it. That's why. What if we push that out to, say, 64? In other words, instead of pushing out the age for full retirement, how about pushing out the age at which you can take it the earliest? Maybe at 64 or 65. I think 65 would be a good number because it matches up with Medicare, and a lot of people have there's a lot of challenges with health care, people trying to bridge that gap from 62 to 65. So if you pushed out the earliest you could take Social Security, I'm not talking about people who are already getting it. Everybody's grandfathered in, either they're already getting it or who are a certain age, but to allow those funds to stay in the Social Security Trust Fund a couple years longer would make a big difference. So that's just another idea. What else? You could uncap or raise the wages on which Social Security is applied. 6.2% of a worker's wages go into Social Security. That's a tax that the employee pays. And then another 1.5 goes for Medicare. And the employer matches that. So your employer pays in 6.2% for your Social Security. So they're in part half of what needs to go in for Social Security, they're paying for half of your Social Security benefits that you're going to receive. A lot of people don't know that. And they're also paying for half of what you're going to get out of Medicare. So that 6.2 applies to a specific dollar amount. The 1.5 is uncapped. The Social Security could, with, of course, legislative action, they can't do it unilaterally. It goes through Congress and the president. that could be raised, and that would help with a shortfall to where the 6.2 might apply to a larger dollar amount of wages. You could also make it more harsh if somebody takes Social Security early and is still working and is drawing Social Security benefits. You could change the rules to make that, create a disincentive for that, again, to get people to wait on drawing Social Security if they are still able to work and have income. There are a variety of other things that can be done. You can even limit the benefits that somebody who, once they make a certain amount of income, that they could be have a reduction in their benefits. If you have a certain amount of income right now, if you're over a certain amount, then the Social Security benefits you receive are taxed as much as 85%. That could be raised to 100%. It could be raised above 100% to in effect, start taking away benefits. I mean, if you're making $10 million a year, do you really need Social Security benefits? No, I think that's an obvious answer. Now, are you entitled? Absolutely. But we're looking for ways to save it, solve it, keep it for most Americans. And when you start trying to tinker with it, a lot of these options should be on the table. Now, one of the other things that recently, at the time I'm doing this program for you, the Congress and the President, here we go as an example, just made some changes to some of the different filing techniques that are available, especially for couples, where you could do different things as a couple where you might file and suspend your benefit so that then your spouse could draw off of yours, or you might file for spousal benefits. There's a whole bunch of different combination of techniques that allowed, up until the passage of this this legislation, allowed couples to get more out of Social Security. Now, some politicians deliberately called that gaming the system. It really wasn't. It was just using the rules that were available. But again, as a step to save money, as a budgetary maneuver, and as a way that's ultimately going to help the Social Security Trust Fund, these techniques were eliminated. Today, the strategies that are available for couples to get the most out of their Social Security has changed significantly. So if you find yourself looking at that and you're not sure what to do, and again, with all the information out there, plus these changes, really good time to get a double check and to talk to somebody that knows something about Social Security to make sure that you are taking the Social Security in the best way for your particular circumstance. And don't forget, you got to live long enough to make the most of whatever your strategy is. Do those things and you'll plan stronger.
Since 1997, David Holland has built a solid reputation in our local community as an independent financial advisor. Just as important, Holland Financial's professional team has grown to include 3 experienced certified financial planners, a tax accountant, an attorney, 3 chartered financial consultants, accredited asset management specialists, and certified annuity specialists. Our attentive and professional staff gives prompt and individualized attention to each and every one of our clients. Count on Holland Financial for your financial advice, not only for today, but for many years to come. Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us online at planstronger.com.
Welcome back. So, when the skies are clear, the sun is shining, the forecast is beautiful, do you pack an umbrella? Sometimes I do. It's almost like an insurance policy. If I have my umbrella in my car, it's sure not to rain, right? Well, it serves as an outstanding analogy for the financial markets. When the skies are clear, it seems pointless to pack an umbrella. And when the stock market is doing very well, and when the economy appears to be clicking on all 12 cylinders, it seems unnecessary to worry much about the market. You let it ride. You focus on other things, about including how to spend all those gains. But we have seen in the past that when things are going well, sometimes then not long after, the wheels come off. So I've got a couple of information pieces I'll share with you that I think are going to be very helpful in making this point. Here's the quote. It is not likely that the United States will experience a recession in 2008. The quote comes from Diana Roth, Chief Economist, U.S. Department of Labor, 2003-2005. This now infamously faulty prediction from 2007 demonstrates how even really smart people who are plugged into all the information out there still got it wrong. Got it wrong in a big way. And in 2008, the stock markets, the prevailing U.S. markets, were down about 38%, despite that seemingly bold yet reasonable prediction. And to be fair to Ms. Roth, she wasn't alone. Many of her fellow economists were only mildly concerned about the risks of a downturn or slowdown in the economy. And at the same time, many individual investors maintained very heavy stock-based portfolios during that time period. Remember, we were coming from a 2003 to 2007 strong bull market that was a recovery from the previous bear market from 2000 to 2002, where the market had lost some 47% or so. So from 2000 to 2002, loss of 47%. 2003 to 2007, a very strong bull market, and then another 38% drop in 2008. And since then, we've had a sustained bull market that is, at the time of this program, well into 2015. And even with a correction doesn't kill a bull. It takes a bear to kill a bull. The correction that we saw in the August-September time period, still a bull, still strong market performance. Now, in the face of all this, a lot of investors have found themselves with the expectations when things are going well, when the sun is shining, when the humidity falls, when the skies are clear and it just feels great to be outside, with that kind of feeling about their investment portfolios, they kind of leave themselves underprotected, you know, not really worrying about being able to get to shelter because there's no clouds. Why am I worried? Well, when the storms hit, people get hurt who aren't ready. So there's a strong argument that can be made looking at what's happened historically. What's happened historically has been nothing short of just pure carnage. It's been brutal when you see your portfolio. I don't need to remind you, but if you weren't investing in 2008, to see your portfolio drop by 38%, or to go back to 2000 to 2002, to see your portfolio over a three-year period bleed 47%. You put $100,000 in and it's worth $50,000 and you're drawing against it because you need the income. Ugly, ugly, ugly. So to deal with all that, you know what I'm going to say, be prepared, right? Be prepared. A well-prepared person, investor. You need to embrace this idea of being prepared for a variety of situations, which means your portfolio needs to be prepared. You can't be all in all the time. You have to have liquidity. You can't put yourself, as real estate investors found themselves in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, they can't allow themselves to be so invested in real estate that there's no liquidity. And if they freeze your line of credit that you have on your house, you can't get to the money. And then the values fall. Now, where are you? Now you've got a more, it just gets really bad. So you want to be prepared. You want to know that these storms can come. Now, the next obvious piece of advice is you don't wait until the storm is here upon you to try to make these changes, because then, well, it may be too late. You know, if the meteorologists, you know, I'm sure there's an association of some sort, they all get together and they say, look, next 10 years, no hurricanes, no storms. It's just going to be peaceful, easy, nothing. No niños, no niñas, none of that. Do you then go and cancel your hurricane or your insurances? No, you don't. Okay. So don't do that with your portfolios. You know, when you diversify, that's a bit like portfolio insurance. You're not betting on any one thing doing very well. You've got stocks. Maybe you've got bonds. Maybe you've got cash and CDs. Maybe you've got some real estate. Maybe you've got some insurance-based program like a fixed annuity. You've got a smattering of these different things which help to insulate you against what may happen. You know, it's a little bit like I'm pulling an analogy in my mind. This happens a lot of times while I'm talking. I just thought of an analogy for you of different types of race cars. You know, if you've got the ones that they use, the drag race cars, they put in this some alcohol content. They have parachutes on the back of them to catch them. And they are designed to do one thing and one thing only, to go straight down the track, no turning, and they get to the quarter mile in seconds, okay? But if you try to put that into an environment where maybe there's a lot of wind, or they've got to make turns, or heaven forbid they run into each other, it's not going to work. So what we need is the ability for your vehicle to not just to be built for one specific drag race. It needs to be able to deal with the fact that you may bump into other cars, that you might have to slam on your brakes, that you might have to actually turn your car. So there needs to be that ability to adapt. And yes, that means that if the stock market is on fire, and if you had been in a dragster, you would have gone a lot faster. We know that. That's just part of the deal. So large cap U.S. stocks have a really good year. The fact that you have those other things, you're probably going to miss out on some of those gains. That's just the way it is. But if it doesn't, and we have another 2008 or a 2000 to 2002 where you lose 47%, the fact that you have those other things, and I've looked at it, and a lot of people have looked at it going backwards, it will insulate you from such large losses. Trust me. Do these things, plan that better, and you'll plan stronger.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.